Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Sarah Stevens, and I will be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequests of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students practical politics and citizen involvement in the government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships here, locally, and in 35 countries around the globe, also in D.C. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to visit our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. Today's forum is brought to you by the Sam Rich Program of International Politics. The title of today's forum is Your Future Career Depends Upon Global Engagement. Today's guest is James Mayfield. James Mayfield is the co-founder of Choice Humanitarian, a strategic non-governmental agency currently working in 5 countries with a goal to end extreme poverty and improve the quality of life through a bottom-up, self-developing, village-centered approach. He is the author of the Village Self-Development Model. He is Professor Emeritus in Public Administration and Middle East Studies at the University of Utah. Currently, he serves as a consultant to governments in 15 countries. Please join me in welcoming our guest.
Wonderful group to see. And I want to share with you some thoughts about a career in international development and international poverty alleviation. It's really amazing how this university has changed since I first came. I was 9 years old, and my mother brought me up to the Kingsbury Hall to observe a child's theater presentation called Tom Sawyer. And as we walked onto the campus, there was literally nothing above where the back of the park building is. Just a big field. Just a huge field. And then the way up, almost to the mountains, it seemed to me, were the old barracks from World War II. And most of my early classes on this campus were in those barracks, and they're still there. But I wanted to share with you some thoughts about why you ought to consider an internship with the Hinckley Institute. We go back to Robert Hinckley, the pitcher, a successful businessman here in Salt Lake, started this tremendous organization in 1965. He invited a young faculty, at that time young faculty, J.D. Williams. And I have to tell you that J.D. Williams, first as a professor of mine, and then as a colleague in this department, became the director of this institute. And for 10 years, from 65 to 75, and then R.J. Snow from 75 to 85, and then Ted Wilson. How many of you have known of Ted Wilson? Anybody? Okay. I mean, it's amazing how history sort of essentially makes people like Ted Wilson invisible. Because he was the chairman and the director of this institute for 18 years, from 2003, I think it was, when he retired. And then Dan Jones, for a couple of years, was an interim chair. And then, of course, Kirk Jowers. And we're thrilled that that tradition has continued. I want you to know that well over 5,000 students have been interns in this program. And we started out as it being sort of a local politics and interns with political candidates. And then we sort of expanded beyond that to look at the whole state. And then we finally decided to go throughout the United States. And now today we have internship opportunities in, if my count is right, it's 36 countries since the beginning, and students are now having opportunities to work in many countries. In order for you to understand the relationship between myself and this institute and what I think are the tremendous opportunities for international internships, you have to understand that in 1983, roughly, I was teaching a series of classes on international development. And my focus was really on the third world, looking at the problems of world poverty. It is amazing. I've spent my whole career trying to understand why 20% of the world, 20% of the world has access to 80% of the world's wealth. And the bottom 40% of humanity has access to less than 1% of the world's wealth. In fact, the 100 richest billionaires in this world have access to more wealth than the bottom 100 countries of this world. And this inequality, this amazing gap between the incredible wealth that we see in the first world, North America, Western Europe, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, the more industrialized nations, literally have access to wealth that people in Africa and Asia can't even imagine. Can't even imagine. So, what are we going to talk about today? Number one, I want to give you a sense of where the world's going. In 1960, can't believe it's how quickly time passes. In 1960, JFK was the president, and he said something in his address that ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. And that statement has stayed with me over these many years. And I've struggled with the whole question about how do you eliminate poverty? I mean, is it really possible? Is it really possible to eliminate poverty? By the year 2000, the United Nations announced to the world that they were going to try to eliminate poverty, not eliminate poverty, but to reduce poverty by 50%. Between the year 2000 and the year 2015. Now we're almost to 2014. In some countries, poverty has been reduced 50%. But unfortunately, in the vast majority of the countries of this world, I mean the really poor countries of this world, poverty has not been reduced 50%. And it's as if it's not possible. It's not possible. But I want to suggest to you today that I believe that it is possible. And your generation, you are the generation that will see extreme poverty eliminated in this world. And I want to see if I can share some thoughts about that that will give you the same kind of hope for that possibility that I have. Now, I'm almost 80. Yuck. And I've seen a lot of things. I remember as a young Fulbright, 1966, September 17th, 1966, I arrive in Egypt on a Fulbright. And I spent 2 years living in Egyptian villages, trying to understand why is it that we have so much wealth and people living in villages around the world have such a small amount, no electricity. I visited probably 50 villages during that two-year period. None of them had electricity. None of them had potable water. None of these villages had even a middle school or a high school. Most of them had primary schools. Most of them did not have any health care services at all. Now, let's go to 1995, 66, 65 to 95, 30 years later. All of these 50 villages now have electricity. Every one of these villages now has a middle school, and about half of them have their own high school. Every one of them now have health clinics. And the reason for this, of course, is because of the tremendous amount of resources that have been invested in trying to reduce, alleviate poverty. And I've wrestled with this question because when we were first thinking about how do you solve poverty, the economists of the world were suggesting that the way you eliminate poverty is through industrialization. In the 50s, 60s, people were saying, if you want to reduce poverty in this world, the way you do that is to industrialize these countries. And thousands, millions, billions of dollars were invested trying to industrialize some of these countries. The unintended consequence was that by the end of the 50s, there had been industries established in many of these countries. But poverty was greater than it had been 10 years previous. And in fact, the real tragedy was that they essentially ignored the rural areas where 80% of the extreme poverty lived. They just ignored the rural. In fact, the argument was the only reason we would even be concerned about the rural areas of the world is that they produce babies. And babies grow up to be factory workers. That was in their minds. Villagers had no value except as possibly bringing them into cities where they would become workers in factories. In the 1960s, there were serious famines throughout the world. And that was when I was first in Egypt. And I remember talking to villagers who said, yes, President Nasser has built these factories and we're producing radios and we're producing refrigerators and we're producing other items, but we're hungry. You can't eat a radio. You can't slice up a refrigerator. Industrialization is not eliminating poverty. In fact, it's exacerbating poverty, making it worse. Because now the resources that might have been used in the rural areas is now being only used in the urban areas. So in the 60s, it was assumed that the solution to poverty would be to focus on agricultural production. We talked about the Green Revolution of the 60s, where using high-yield varieties of seeds and fertilizers and insecticides and modern tractors, we could then eliminate poverty in the third world. By the end of the 60s, another set of unintended consequences. The only people that benefited from the Green Revolution, from the fertilizers and the seeds and the insecticides, the only things that they benefited, the only people that benefited were the rich farmers. The rich farmers took advantage of the tractors and the high-yield varieties of seeds and fertilizers, and their income skyrocketed during the 60s. And the poorest of the poor were worse off than they'd been prior to the beginning of the 60s. So in the 70s, they said, well, what we need to focus on is the basic needs. Let's focus on the basic needs of the people in the third world, make sure they have water and they have adequate food and they have health care and they have schools. And that will eliminate poverty. Now, that was when I first began my career as a consultant. It was in the 70s. And I was hired by USAID, sometimes with UNDP, a number of national organizations. And my job was to go to Egypt or go to the Philippines or go to Sri Lanka, go to Sudan and train central ministries to deliver these services. Okay? I mean, the Ministry of Health would provide services of health to the villages. The Ministry of Agriculture would provide services of agricultural extension work. Now, it's been suggested that there was probably $500 billion spent in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Where did this money, most of it, go? Well, two places. When these ministries became the dominant vehicle for development, and this became a common approach, the idea was, first of all, we have to build huge buildings. I mean, bureaucrats need offices. They need air conditioning. And they need lots of filing cabinets. And they need vehicles so they can drive to the villages. And so by the time the buildings were built and the filing cabinets were filled with files, they had used up 80% of the money. Well, let's say 65% of the money. And then another 20% were used to pay people like me. I can still remember, as a young PhD, just starting to teach here at the University of Utah, and they send me a first-class airplane ticket, and I fly in comfort. I arrive in Cairo. I stay in a 5-star hotel, and then I talk to bureaucrats for a month, and they pay me this enormous $300 a day consulting fee. Huh. I was in heaven. Every summer, I'm not in Salt Lake City. I'm in Manila or Jakarta or Cairo. So who benefits from all of this money that was spent to eliminate poverty? First of all, the bureaucrats, and secondly, the consultants. Okay? So by the end of the 70s, it was clear that what we were trying to do was not working. It was not eliminating poverty. In fact, it was just helping professors and bureaucrats to have a good life. And the villages didn't change much. It didn't change very much. Now in the 80s, something kind of exciting happened. A group of my students and a wonderful young local dentist, Tim Evans, we thought about maybe starting our own little non-government organization, an NGO called Choice Humanitarian. And the idea in our mind was, these top-down programs that start with central ministries are only benefiting people who live in cities. They don't benefit the real poor that live out in the villages of the world. So we're going to start taking our students and we're going to go to these countries and work at the village level. And that seemed really exciting. We're going to work at the village level. We're going to help them build schools and put water systems in. And we're going to set up clinics for health. And the villagers loved us when we would come. And we'd build a little school, a little health clinic. But by the end of the 1980s, another unintended consequence. As soon as we left, within a few years, the school was falling down. The health clinic didn't have medicine. The water pumps that we put in didn't work. I remember attending, it was a research project that I was involved with, to evaluate a U.S. aid project in Indonesia, $27 million project. They put in water systems all over the island of Java, wonderful water systems all over Java. And we were so excited. They needed the water. We had the money. Let's spend it. I go back to Indonesia 5 years later. And to my shock, 83% of these water systems were not working. No, they weren't working. And I'm sitting there with a group of village leaders, 1994. And I'm trying to understand why after we spent all this money, you still don't have water. What's going on? And that's when I had an epiphany. Honestly, an epiphany that changed my whole mindset about development. When the village leader looked at me and said, "Mr. Mayfield, it's very simple. We're waiting for you Americans to come back and fix your pumps." Whose pumps were they? They were our pumps. There was no ownership for those pumps. There was no sense of responsibility for those pumps. We had assumed that if we give them things, that will bring them out of poverty. We assumed that if we give things to people, that somehow, miraculously, they will know how to come out of poverty. So the 80s was a painful period, a very painful period, when we realized that most of the do-gooders of the world, and unfortunately, there's too many of them still doing the same thing, going over there, giving them things, free food, free clothing, and then wondering why, when they come back a few years later, nothing's changed. I want to suggest to you that the challenge is not to change the villages of the world. You can bring a school to a village or a health clinic. What has to happen is you have to change the villagers, not the villages. Until the villagers have a sense of responsibility, have a sense of commitment and ownership for their own development, nothing's really going to change. Nothing's really going to change. Now, I tell you these kinds of stories because all of you have wonderful opportunities to be interns overseas and to go into countries where poverty is very, very severe and very serious. We right now, we've had interns go on choice expeditions and choice internships in about 10 countries. We've had interns in Indonesia. We've had interns in India. We've had interns in Samoa and in Vietnam. We've had interns in Mexico and Guatemala and Bolivia. We've had interns in Egypt. We've had interns in Kenya. So there's been a lot of wonderful opportunities. But over the years, we have struggled with these unintended consequences. That's the frustration of my whole professional career. No matter how smart we think we are, no matter how much we think we've prepared for these projects to have a difference, make a difference in the world, things don't seem to change. Now, I want to suggest to you that something has changed. Dramatic change. In the 90s, we started hiring local experts to run these projects. And many of these projects, many of these experts, experts in livestock, experts in education, health, and so forth, And they were dedicated, they were from the countries, they spoke the language, they knew the local culture, and we were thinking that by hiring people from the country and observing and helping them. But then we began to realize the unintended consequences of that was if you hire someone who's an expert in health, all of the projects are going to be what? In health. If you hire a livestock expert, all of the projects are going to be in livestock. Now, did they need livestock projects? Yes. Did they need health projects? Yes. But the problem was that as these local experts would come into the village, the villagers would wait for them to tell them what they needed to do. There was no sense of responsibility. What are we going to do? It was, what's this expert going to do for us? And that's when we decided a new approach was needed. And we called it the Self-Developing Village Program. And Chris, would you stand, please? I don't want to embarrass you, but I want you to stand. Chris Johnson has been with Choice since the early 90s, and he and I are blood brothers. And I want you to know that this idea of a self-developing village program came out of his experience and my experience, and we tried to do this together. What's interesting about this is that what we began to say to the villagers is, if you want development, it's your responsibility. We can help you, we can facilitate it, but you need to take responsibility for your development. You need to say to yourself, what do we need? Not what are they going to give us, but what do we need, what do we really need? And then simply work towards that, learning how to mobilize their own resources, learning how to plan their own programs, so that it becomes what? Their programs, not some outsider coming in to do something for them. And it was clear that this was going to be really good. And as these leaders began to take responsibility, it was very exciting to see this. Very exciting to see this. Because they were then mobilizing their resources. They were going out and leveraging their funds with government agencies and with other NGOs, and they were raising the resources to do their own projects. And we thought, now we've got it. Now we have the solution. What's the phrase? Unintended consequences. Damn! We began to realize that when you train leaders to take responsibility, the realities of political life in these villages is pretty predictable. There are wealthy villagers, there are middle poor villagers, and then there are extremely poor villagers in every village. When you go into a village, it looks like everybody's poor. But in every village I've ever worked in, there's always a few that are called the rich poor. They'll have a bicycle. Now they're rich. And then there's the middle poor. They at least have two meals a day. And then there's the extreme poor, who are lucky to have one meal a day. Okay? And so when these village leaders start taking responsibility for their own development, we began to realize two things that happened. Number one, too many of the projects tended to go for the benefit of the middle poor and the upper poor. Okay, that was one unintended consequence. The second unintended consequence was that most of the projects that they implemented generally tended to increase their ability to cope with poverty. Not to come out of poverty, but to cope with poverty. Okay? So now they've got a school, now they've got a water system, they're coping with poverty pretty well, but they're still poor. So then the question is, okay, what's the solution? And by the year 2010, we had essentially decided that something is still missing. And one of the things we thought about was, well, let's introduce local economic development. If we can just introduce local economic development, help them develop their own enterprises, their own income-generating activities, their own employment enhancement activities, that then they could bring themselves out of poverty. The problem, of course, and USAID and the World Bank are now discovering this, that when you emphasize local economic development, you tend to help some people come out of poverty. No question. Some people come out of poverty. But the real unintended consequence is that the gap between the middle and upper poor and the extreme poor, that gap increases. Okay? It increases. So we still have this tragic challenge of extreme poverty. And that's why something happened a year ago when I was invited to Nepal to receive, on behalf of choice, a letter of appreciation from the president of Nepal, a man by the name of Baram Yadav, Dr. Yadav. He's a physician, democratically elected president of Nepal, one of the most beautiful countries in the world, but also one of the poorest countries in the world. And as we were talking, he mentioned something to me when he said, I've noticed that the choice model, which is focusing on training leaders to take responsibility for their own development and developing their economic resources and assets as they begin to cope with their poverty and some move out of poverty. But he said, I've noticed that you tend to work in clusters of villages, maybe 10, 15 villages at a time. I'm wondering, he said to me, would it be possible for you to work in a large area, like a district, like 100,000 villagers, like 20,000 families all at once? Could you do a program with 20,000 people and bring them out of poverty? And I said, well, yes, but there will probably be unintended consequences. But I think you see where I'm going. What we were doing in the 80s was based on very good intentions. What we did in the 90s was based on very good intentions. But we began to realize that if you want to eliminate poverty, you need to help the villagers take themselves out of poverty. Don't you take them out of poverty. You help them take themselves out of poverty. And if you don't, the unintended consequence will be that you simply increase dependency on you, the outsider, trying to help them. Now, I don't know if we have time, but I wanted to show just a couple of pictures. Let's see if we can find some of those. Okay. I want to show you a little technology. I hope this will come up. I want you to look at this. This is a biodigester. If you take animal waste from the buffalo, from the animals, and from the humans, and you put this in this biodigester, it generates methane gas. Now, you might ask the question, and this is a trick question. What is the relationship between a water buffalo and a woman's life expectancy? Trick question. What is the relationship between a water buffalo and a woman's life expectancy? In Nepal, where women cook in an open fire in their kitchen, their life expectancy is 38 years. Life expectancy, 38 years. When they're breathing that smoke day after day after day, they die of respiratory disease. If you take a buffalo, you give them a buffalo, and the waste of that buffalo is made into methane gas, and you pipe that methane gas into her kitchen, and now you have odorless, smokeless, pure flame, and they can cook from that flame. She doesn't breathe the smoke, and her life expectancy jumps to 58 years. And the buffalo produces milk for their family, but the surplus can then be sold. And now we don't have to cut down the forest to feed the fires, and so you're reducing this deforestation. 40% of the prime lumber areas of Nepal have been destroyed by the poor needing the wood to cook their food. Now, if you use animal waste and human waste, suddenly you solve a major problem, and that family is out of poverty, extreme poverty. So we've thought about Can we help them? That's just one simple technology, and there's at least five dozen other technologies that can be introduced that can help them take themselves out of poverty. So, we see how we go. Come on. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to do this. No, not going to work. Do you want to see if you can make this? Oh, I can get the pictures. I just need it on the side.
Let's try to do full screen.
Yeah, I'm not sure where it is. See, there's a, you can see all of the pictures on the side. So that's what I need to see.
Over here.
No, there they are. Okay. I want to show you a kitchen. Clean kitchen. There's the, you see the line of gas coming into her kitchen, and now she's cooking without smoke. Last June, I went to Nepal, and I can see that we don't have time to cover it as much as I'd like to. But I spent 6 weeks in Nepal, training 20 village development or rural development facilitators, and I'm not too familiar with how to make this work, so I guess I won't use it. We trained 20 village development facilitators and assigned them to each one to a village development council area, about 5,000 people. So we're working in an area of 100,000 people, 20,000 families, and each of these village development council areas are being taught and how to develop themselves to bring themselves out of poverty. And it's really interesting. In 2013, May of 2013, the United Nations announced a new set of goals for the year 2015 to 2030. And what is really interesting to me is that these goals for the next 15 years start with this premise. Between now and 2030, think in your mind, how old will you be in 2030? Okay? 15 years, 17 years from now. The United Nations has announced their commitment to try to eliminate extreme poverty in the world by the year 2030. And I think we can do it. And the internship program of this institute has an opportunity to provide students with opportunities to work in a number of countries where this particular activity is now going to be implemented. I have no illusions that there won't be unintended consequences. There is no such thing as a silver bullet. It solves all problems. But I am absolutely convinced that when you let villagers take responsibility for their own development and you teach them in proper results-based management and you teach them how to organize their own projects and how to develop their own industries and their own enterprises, that they can do this. And they can do it with our help, but the money will not be wasted as it's so often been wasted, because the money goes down and stays in the village where it belongs. So this is the challenge. This is the opportunity. And I'm hoping that all of you will consider making a career in the field of poverty elimination. This is the generation to do that. And I won't be around in the year 2030. I'd like to be, but I won't be here. But you will be. And this is an amazing opportunity for you to be involved. And I think right now I'd like to open it up for questions, and then we'll go from there. Please. No.
If you have a question, just stand up, state your name clearly, give a little bit about yourself, and wait till you get the microphone to actually talk. So.
Hi, my name is Jordan Abawi, and I am a senior in political science and education. I would like to ask you your opinion on the role of refugees in contributing to poverty. I'm thinking in particular states like Jordan, which are approximately 1 in 2 people are refugees, and the largest portion of people impoverished in the nation are refugees.
Yeah, Ethiopia, I mean, there's a lot of places where they exist. And they are probably, they're certainly less than 5% of the extreme poor in the world, but they're a significant group. I know of one very interesting program that's now being developed, and it's based on an organization called Concero Connect. And what they've tried to do is to develop the ability to connect via satellite to the refugee camps and begin a process of education, training, outsourcing of work opportunities in these refugee camps, and I think that's a real possibility, one exciting way to begin to deal with that problem. Okay?
George, if you could, as a sophomore student, talk about the different case studies as far as helping third world.
Speak a little louder.
You talked about the different case studies as far as helping third world countries, industrialization and so forth, and it's taken almost a decade to realize that it's not a success. As far as educating these third world countries to fend for themselves, how long do you feel it's going to take to realize that it might be a success or a failure?
Well, this program, 2015 to 2030, it's based on, and just very quickly, it's based on we're going to eliminate extreme poverty. That is, everybody making less than $1 a day should be making $2 a day by the year 2030. And all that means when they move from extreme poverty to middle poverty is that now they have food every day, and now their children go to school, and now they have access to some medical care, and now they are able to start their own little businesses, start their own savings programs, their own access to credit, and move themselves out of poverty. That's clearly, but the fifth aspect of this, which has not been emphasized before, and that is we need to have baseline data where we can say these are the people that are extremely poor. We've identified them, we've measured their poverty, and over the years, then we go back a year later and we do another baseline data study, and we see have we made any progress. But if we don't do the first baseline data study, there's no way that we'll be able to measure progress. And the Grameen Bank, I don't know if you know of the Grameen Foundation, they've developed something called the PPI, the Progress Out of Poverty Index. It's a very simple little index. You can go into a village, you collect data from that village, and you can identify who are the extreme poor. Then you go back a year later, and has that been reduced or is it higher? And you'll be able to make some progress. And that's how you do that, it seems to me. Okay? Someone here? Oh, sorry about that. We'll get to you eventually.
My name is Michelle, and I'm studying social work here at the U. And my question is a little bit more personal for you. At what point did you decide to focus internationally instead of domestically for poverty?
Personally, it happened my first opportunity to leave this country and work in another country. I was a young Mormon missionary in Finland, and that was my first experience outside of the country, and I fell in love with just the possibility of living in another society, another culture, another way of life. It was an amazing experience for me. Then when I had that Fulbright experience in 1966, that's really when it started. As I watched how these villagers were surviving, And it always amazed me, in all of their poverty, they were a happy people. And it just dawned on me, when they're sad, it's because a child has died that didn't need to die. If they'd been vaccinated, they wouldn't have died. And that's when it just dawned on me that I really wanted to spend my life seeing if we could find a way to eliminate extreme poverty. Thank you. Okay? Yeah.
I'm Brian in social work. So I was wondering, with your new initiative to create the methane gas and put in the line to the home, did you also teach the village people like how to fix the pipes and give them the resources to do that? Because it seems like that would be the only way to prevent the same thing from happening as happened in the 80s.
I think you've been listening today. Thank you. It's absolutely amazing the effort we've gone through. When we go into a village, the first thing we say is, would you like to have a smoke-free kitchen? Yes, we'd like to have a free... Okay, now, how are you going to get this smoke-free kitchen? Who's going to take care of the biodigester after you've built it? And we go through a long process of dialoguing with these communities and making them find solutions to these kinds of issues. And it's interesting. Right now, we're creating a new industry in Nepal. It's called Biodigester Repair Man. And for me, that's an industry by itself. And it's a new job, and they now recognize the need for it, and they're taking responsibility themselves. It's a great question. Thank you.
Hey, I'm Andrew, majoring in international studies and philosophy. I've been on two choice trips with through the subgroup SHE and loved them, and I fully believe in the model. Because I've read some different things made on it, like different schools of thought and development, like Jeffrey Sachs and W. Samuel, and then I found them problematic. I feel like this self-development model is very complete. So my question is, do you see this growing? Are other organizations taking on this model?
It's our hope. I'll just say two things. Number one, the United Nations has announced that they're going to eliminate poverty, that they want to eliminate extreme poverty. But no one's talking about how are they going to do it. I've yet to see any serious effort to define what exactly it is that they are going to do to eliminate this extreme poverty. And it seems to me that is... That's the crucial question. So for the next 3 years, my wife has given me permission to work in Nepal for 3 more years. She says, it's time for you to play with your grandchildren. You need to play more golf. Why don't you go fishing? Why do you have to go to Nepal? Dear, please, give me 3 more years. So I have 3 years to test this model. And I'm convinced that we're going to find that this model can be replicated. We have a budget of about $20,000 a month, and this budget is now being matched. The $20,000 a month is matched by the Nepalese government. I met with the chief administrative officer in this district where we're working in Nepal. And I explained to him that the way we want to work in these areas is to train the village leaders to take responsibility for their own development and to identify the extreme poor, and the village community helps the extreme poor out of poverty. And he said, okay, so you're going to train the village, these village councils, you're going to train them, right? And I said, yes. And we want to train them in good governance and management and all the aspects of development. Then he says to me, if you're going to do that, he said, you know, we have a budget for these councils, but we've never been willing to give this money to the councils because they're corrupt, they're incompetent, they don't know how to use the money, they waste it, and so forth. But if you have a full-time Nepali working in this council and working with this council over this 3-year curriculum that we take every council member through, I'm willing to match Nepalese money with your money. So we're now at $40,000 a month. working in these 180 villages, and we're leveraging that about five times. For every $1,000 we give, the villagers themselves are matching that with relationships with governments, other NGOs, other private donors, and we're convinced that in the next 3 years, we're going to eliminate. Now, notice it's 20,000 families. 45% of those 20,000 families are in extreme poverty. Okay, so that's 9,000 families. So we're working with 9,000 families in extreme poverty, and we hope to eliminate that form of extreme poverty in the next 3 years. My wife will be happy, and hopefully we'll have a manual and a program that we can present to the United Nations and say, go replicate this throughout the world. That's our hope.
Hi, my name is Jesse Buchanan. I'm a biology major here. With programs like microfinancing, like you said, they're not complete models.
Mm-hmm.
Those programs have sort of economically sustainable models, though, like with banks, the ones giving the money. Do you think there's a way to change that as far as to get it to these programs, changing the money, basically, from those to these?
I need an hour to answer your question. It's a tough question. I guess what I can say to you is that microcredit, where you give these small loans to poor women, helps them to cope with poverty. It doesn't take them out of poverty. You really need to have enterprises where people can work for an income that allows them to be out of poverty. And that's why we're shifting away from microcredit. We see that as something we might do the first year, but by the third year, we want these people moving to medium-sized, larger enterprises, that, if that's what they want to do, rather than agriculture. Okay.
On behalf of the Hinckley Institute of Politics, we'd like to thank James Mayfield for giving us an excellent and informative forum.
You're welcome to take questions after if you want, just for the recording.